Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And time now for our Week in Review.
Their whole case is hinged on getting one juror to believe that, in fact, he's not a jihadist.
Our public records laws need to be updated. They need to be modernized. Transparency is so important.
This is my backyard, and if they have the Olympics, it's going to be trashed.
This week's support for the Olympics takes a nosedive. A lack of transparency in Massachusetts public records and physical evidence in the Tsarnaev trial. That is our Week in Review, and here to wade through it all with us is John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and the fleet fingers at the keyboard of the Campaign Outsider blog. Good to see you again, John.
Thanks for the plug, Megan.
Also here is Mike Ross, former Boston City Councilor and currently an attorney at Prince Lobel in Boston. Mike Ross, great to see you again.
And thank you for that plug.
All right, well, let's start off with the latest in the trial of admitted Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. This week, prosecutors presented physical evidence, including alleged jihadist propaganda on Tsarnaev's computers and phones. In our special Finish Line podcast, WBUR's David Boeri and The Globe's Kevin Cullen discussed what the defense strategy might be.
Their whole case is just hinged on getting one juror to believe that, in fact, he didn't become a jihadist, that he's somebody who is a psychological hostage of his brother, following his brother.
And obviously the defense, when they get their crack, are going to say, how do you know he downloaded this stuff? Unless you're standing over somebody's shoulder, you don't know who's on that computer.
All right, John, so let's start with you. I mean, we are getting a glimpse into the fact that here's where the defense might want to start driving a little wedge in the prosecution's case. Do you think that they've got a chance?
I think they have a chance. I mean, it's really interesting to see how quickly the trial is going. There have been 69 witnesses over 9 days. It feels like the defense just wants to get this part over with so they can get to the sentencing part. And some have questioned whether they're even going to call any witnesses for the defense. So I think that one of the interesting things is, can they plant enough doubt in the jurors' minds in this phase that will linger over into the next phase? And I think they're trying to make the case. It's happened before. It happened in the Washington sniper case with Lee Malvo and John Allen Muhammad, where they convinced the jury that the younger one was unduly influenced by the older one, and he got life, no parole, whereas John Allen Muhammad was executed.
Oh, interesting. So Mike, I mean, on John's point, how do you think, you know, either the prosecution or the defense are doing right now in terms of showing what, you know, each one believes was Tsarnaev's relative involvement or investment in the jihadist cause here?
Well, I mean, we'll know how they did and how they're doing, you know, at the end of this trial, frankly.
The jury really has final say on that. I agree.
Right. But I mean, basically, they're doing the only thing they can do. I mean, they've given up the fact that, you know, he's guilty. So now all they can argue is really just this one thing, which is basically, you know, the duress that he was under from being under the influence of someone else. It's only designed to, you know, avoid the death penalty. And that is really what they're entire case is all about.
Now, let me just ask you both a very super quick question, because I'm wondering if at this point in time, do you think that Greater Boston, we all are residents here, I mean, have we been hearing enough about this trial? Because there has been some chatter out there about, you know, especially we heard from victims, et cetera, that, you know, maybe it's sort of re-traumatizing folks all over again.
There's a possibility that I think the media has been generally restrained about this. There have been exceptions, but generally restrained about in the coverage of the trial. And it hasn't turned into sort of that kind of media zoo that we've seen in other trials. I think that consideration overall is the sort of the emotional wear and tear and psychological wear and tear on the public is going to enter into the sort of decision as well in terms of life, no parole, or capital punishment, because capital punishment appeals last forever. And so there's no end to it under those circumstances.
Mike, your quick thought on that?
Yeah, I think people are listening to this at two levels. On one level, they just know this trial's going on and they're kind of paying attention to it. On the other level, it's this emotional punch in the stomach that it happens to all of us, that if you really think about what happened and you really start to really get into it, It's painful. It's emotional. It's difficult for all of us. And I think for that reason, people aren't going deep into it. I think they're just aware it's happening.
Right. Well, let's move on now to the reinvigorated discussion around the state's public records laws. Massachusetts has amongst the weakest public records laws in the country. Technically, it's up to Secretary of State William Galvin's office to decide which government records can be made public, as he explained earlier this week.
Obviously, the media outlets would like to get complete access to all this information, and maybe they're entitled to it. But the question is how do we differentiate between citizens when it comes to applying the law?
Okay. It's up to Attorney General Maura Healey's office, however, to take agencies to court that do not comply with released requests. Here's Maura Healey on WGBH.
You know, my perspective on this is that transparency is so important. Our public records laws need to be updated. They need to be modernized. They need to be made to work in a way that really shows people that government is here to serve them.
Okay, Mike. So AG Healey has said she's looking into possible legislation to strengthen the state's public records laws, and she wants to work with Galvin's office. But Galvin says he wants a voter referendum. What do you think needs to be done here?
Well, there's so much happening here. I mean, it's good that AG Healey is saying this because there has been a horrible relationship between Galvin, and it's a disputed relationship on this because Martha Coakley denied that she wasn't enforcing these orders that Galvin's office would send up to them. And then he just threw his hands up and said, all right, enough. I'm going to stop asking the AG to enforce this because they're not. And that's basically his position. So when Maura Healey comes out and says, we're going to change the relationship, we're going to start working together, that's great. But it also goes to the brokenness of the system. I mean, there are other states like Connecticut or Pennsylvania that have, you know, enforcement mechanisms at the secretary level. What's really broken here, though, is that if you try to go after a state player for blocking access to information, you can't get your attorney fees back,
right?
Like almost every other state in the country,
which can be thousands or tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. So there is therefore no incentive for a bureaucrat to release this information because you'll just let the person work it out, and there's no consequence.
So, John, I wanted to run something by you. Jack Sullivan at Mass Inc. wrote something which really caught my eye. He wrote, "Secretary of State William Galvin is using all of his fingers to accuse everyone but himself for non-existent enforcement, an often tortured interpretation of the state's woefully weak public records laws."
Yeah, this gives a whole new dimension to Galvin's nickname, the Prince of Darkness, because, you know, I mean, he is basically passing the buck here in every direction possible. And someone else referred to it as throwing everybody else under the bus. And I think that one of the issues here is his interpretation of regulations as statutes and hiding behind sort of, well, there's a statute that says you can't do this, when in actuality it's a regulation. There's a lot of really tangled stuff going on here. I think one of the more interesting developments was the sort of consortium of newspapers that got together. And
the editorial pages, exactly.
Right, that did what they called an unprecedented coordinated condemnation of Galvin's rulings. The Globe and Herald acting in concert, that's one of
the
seven signs of the apocalypse, I think. So that tells you that, you know, people are taking this seriously. It probably won't go away real soon.
Well, let's turn now to one last big story of this week, and that is new numbers regarding Boston's bid to host the 2024 Summer Olympic Games. Okay, so we've got a WBUR poll out that shows that support amongst Boston area residents for hosting the Games has fallen to just 36%. That's a 15-point drop from January. But is Boston 2024 CEO Richard Davey worried? Nah.
I'm not concerned. You know, it's obvious we're just getting started with going out and answering questions and really building enthusiasm for the Olympics. And obviously, we've lived through one of the most difficult winters that certainly I can remember, and I know a lot of Bostonians can remember. So I think that's certainly been impacting, you know, attitudes on all things, including what we think is going to be a great opportunity for the city of Boston.
Well, John, that may be the case, but on the other hand, we also read that former Governor Deval Patrick is now not going to take the $7,500 a day fee that he was being paid by Boston 2024 for basically doing PR for them as well.
Yeah, I'm going to apply for that job. I think that, you know, the people of Boston, the numbers keep going down. The more exposure they have to Boston 2024, the more people are suspicious of what's going on. And it's because of these things like Deval Patrick. First, he's going to earn the money. Now he's not going to earn the money. I mean, there seems to be this sort of reactive gang that can't shoot straight kind of aspect to this effort. And I think the public's looking at it and saying, this is five-ring Monty here, and nobody's dealing the card straight at all to us at this point.
Okay. Well, Mike, I mean, I'm wondering if you share that opinion, because on the other hand, you know, Richard David there was pointing to the weather and the old saying of, if you don't like the weather in New England, just wait a minute. I wonder if people's opinions about the Olympics are going to change minute by minute. We've got 2 years anyway before, I believe, the final proposal has to be submitted.
Right, 2017. You know, I actually agree with him. Marty Walsh said in last month's quote, quote, I'd like to see a poll when we don't have 7 feet of snow on the ground and the transportation system down. I mean, he's right. I mean, but so I think what happened with the snow and with the transportation is it exposed the underbelly of Boston's dirty infrastructure story, really. And I think people are conflating that, as they should, to, man, we can't even manage, you know, getting our trains running when it snows in a major American city. How are we possibly going to be able to pull this one off? And to me, that is the argument to doing the Olympics. So, you know, I feel like they have to, at the Olympics, make that connection, make that argument. And listen, I might be the last, you know, professional that isn't getting paid by this Olympics, but I am waiting for my phone to ring. And I think they need to make that argument, you know, because I think if they do, I think that Bostonians could say, this will force us to upgrade infrastructure. This will force us to do things we've needed to do for a long time.
John, you're giving me that look.
Real quick, a couple of weeks ago, Marty Walsh said, I don't want a referendum, but I would like to see 70% approval of this among the people of Boston. He's a long way away from 70% if he's going to stick with that number. On the other hand, given the track record of Boston 2024, he'll probably revise it really soon.
Okay. Well, fortunately, we have actually quite a long time in terms of the many, many months / years to keep talking about this issue, but we don't have that much time left in the segment today. So let's get to our hubbubs, and that is the story that fell below the fold, so to speak, for us, but is worth a mention anyway. John, let's start with you.
I just want to bring up something that happened yesterday, the death of Danny Schechter. He was the legendary news dissector at WBCN during the 1970s. He was a phenomenal figure. I didn't really know him. I was once accosted by his father, Jerry, at a Stop and Shop for being insufficiently something. I forget what. But Danny Schechter was a truly amazing character in terms of journalism and progressive politics.
Okay, so hold on there. You just did something that in live radio, you just like pulled the rug out from under me, because we were going to spend the last 5 minutes of the show talking about Danny Schechter.
Oh, I'm really sorry. Okay, I have a different hubbub.
No, don't stop. We have introduced the concept of the fact that, and it's worth talking about. I mean, as you mentioned, Danny Schechter, he's a legendary broadcaster. I'm always saying that because we actually have tape. We have great tape of Schechter, and we want to play it now.
I'm so sorry.
From 1970 to 1980, he was with BCN, the news dissector, as you said. We've got a little tape here about how he's explained how he got that title by accident when a radio announcer at BCN couldn't even read Schechter's handwriting.
I was thrown on the air, and he introduced me. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the news inspector, the news digester, the news dissector. News dissector, that sounded pretty unique and good, so I basically latched onto it, and I'm still known as the news dissector in journalism all around the world, and now write a blog under that name.
Okay, so John, I want to actually talk about a little bit more about this. How big was he in Boston?
He was major in Boston, and one of the interesting things was he felt like one of our own, as opposed to some of the other progressive voices like I.F. Stone and George Seldes. He really felt like he belonged to the group that was listening to WBCN, and he was charismatic, he was magnetic, he was really smart, and amazingly prolific. He produced 12 books. He produced 6 films on Nelson Mandela alone. He was a producer for 2020, won a couple of Emmys. He produced all kinds of public broadcast television shows. I mean, he was a remarkable character, and he was part journalist, part activist. And his business partner, Rory O'Connor, called him the original Jacktivist because he combined those two. And he got away with it. Not everybody can get away with that, but Danny did.
And he also talked to some pretty amazing people during his radio tenure here in Boston. We've got even more tape. This is Schechter speaking to, get this, none other than John Lennon and Yoko Ono, right after the Beatles split up. Here they are.
Without getting too personal, what changes has John gone through?
I know that you might think it's very trivial, but he makes biscuits and boiled rice, for instance. And it was sort of like, I mean, you know, in our household, nobody has to do it.
You a good cook?
Man's work is never done, my dear.
No, I just wanted to do it, you know, so I've only actually cooked one meal. You know, if nobody was around, I'd just probably starve to death.
The Beatles wash their own dishes?
I don't know anything about the Beatles.
John Lennon telling Danny Schechter in 1970, we think, I don't know anything about the Beatles. I mean, one more thing I want to ask you, and again, this is just because he was such a major influence in the Boston radio scene. And then, as you said, he was a human rights activist and a journalist and knew a lot of music. I mean, what do you think he's going to be remembered for most going forward? He was 72 when he died yesterday.
I think he'll be remembered mostly for his anti-apartheid activity. I think that he was a confidant of Nelson Mandela. He, as I said, he produced 6 films about him, at least one book about him. And he was out front in terms of campaigning against apartheid, very much in the vanguard. And so I think he'll be remembered for that. He'll be remembered for a number of other things. I think, you know, he was on top of hip-hop before a lot of people were. And I think that, you know, there are people who have the public megaphone who are going to be able to sort of keep his memory alive. And I think he's a major story from that period in terms of journalism, in terms of activism.
Yeah. So Danny Schechter, the news dissector, died yesterday of pancreatic cancer. He was 72. Seems really young still.
Sure does.
In New
sure
York.
Does.
So actually, that was a long but good hubbub, John. Thank you so much.
Sorry.
No, don't ever apologize for bringing us great stories. Mike, your hubbub.
Okay, well, my hubbub is not even near the
don't worry, mine
integrity
will take,
of...
Mine will take the lowest common denominator
okay,
down even lower.
Just wait till you hear mine, and then we'll judge. Space Saver poll. The BUR poll polled a lot of things yesterday, today. It also polled whether or not the public supports space savers. These are the, you know, odd objects that are used to prevent people from parking in spaces after they've been snowed. And if people don't know that who are listening, they've just not been alive for the last few weeks. So it turns out that in Boston, 70% of the people support the use of these space savers, while 26 oppose the practice. So I just, you know, so it says a lot of things to me, but one of the things that's kind of interesting that it says to me is the politics on this are good,
yeah.
Right? So Marty Walsh came out in favor of, you know, he did a spontaneous space saver, like ad hoc policy, like on the fly at a press conference. And he was criticized for that. But I think he knew what he was doing because the people want their space savers. Give the people their space savers.
Where do you stand on this one?
I mean,
counselor?
Look, I'm like an elitist. Like, I got my own, right? People are going to, like, they're going to kill me but I have my own parking space, right? So I don't have to deal. Now, you know, I moved to East Boston, so it's a lot easier to get your own parking space. But, you know, I think that this story, people from other major cities come to Boston and they just can't understand what we're doing, and they really can't believe it. And I think that...
They also can't understand what we're saying either.
Yeah, that too. And I think, you know, I think we need to do less of things like this and more of, like, Olympics, you know?
Oh.
We have to, you know...
You're really, really cutting for that job. I can see every chance you
get. I just want to think big, you know? I think this... Unfortunately, this is a certain parochialism to this that I don't love.
Oh.
And I'm going to get, like... killed and schlacked. But I did admit that I have
send
my own parking
Send your angry
space.
Tweets to Mike
yes.
Ross, not to Radio Boston.
Yeah.
Anthony, what's
yeah.
your hubbub?
All right, well, here's my hubbub. It comes from the great state of Maine, a place where we all need to spend more time, and where Governor Paul LePage got in a bit of a tangle with author Stephen King, who also lives there part of the year. So in LePage's weekly address, he was defending his proposal to reduce the state income tax, and he says that this is part of an effort to keep wealthy Mainers from leaving the state. And he suggested that author Stephen King was one of those folks who had left Maine for Florida to avoid high taxes. The problem is that was contested by none other than Stephen King. And King put out his own statement saying that he and his wife pay every cent of our Maine state income taxes and are glad to do it. He also turned a pretty nice phrase and said, Governor LePage is full of the stuff that makes the grass grow green. So don't mess with an award-winning writer. That's my message to Governor LePage. But anyway, there it is.
Well, my hubbub, quite simply, is Mitt Romney is going to step into the ring with Evander Holyfield for charity, not a Onion headline. It's real.
Right.
Okay.
And John, not wear a shirt from what he said.
That's right. John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University, thanks so much. And Mike Ross, former city councilor, thanks as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.